President Donald Trump's first 100 days.
The first 100 days.
First 100 days.
First 100 days.
This is more work than in my previous life.
Trump's tweets have kept traders on their toes.
Markets have been extremely sensitive to what this administration has said so far. Markets learned that they need to be awake in the middle of the night to follow what Mr. Trump is saying on Twitter.
100 days in office. Since Inauguration Day, the president has been meeting with the country's leading chief executives to get their input on policy, reform, and job creation.
The Trump White House, with great fanfare, rolled out its principles for tax reform on Wednesday.
This is about the most sweeping, biggest tax cuts and sweeping tax reform in history.
But you're going to get deep cuts in corporate tax rates. You're going to get your full expensing, immediate expensing. You're going to get your repatriation. I regard that as very bullish.
We're urging them, don't be chained to that. Go big and bold with this plan. Trust the history of tax cuts and actually increasing revenue because of those tax cuts.
Yeah, and what was the play off the old Reagan line, go big or go home.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, stocks had another good week. Just a couple of indexes that were struggling this week, the more conservative utility index and the Dow Transports, but everything else was looking good. But on Friday, markets headed south as we got a terrible print on first quarter GDP. It's the lowest growth rate that we've seen in 3 years, with GDP only growing 0.7%. It's going to be interesting to see what the Fed does with these weak numbers, and especially that the second quarter is not off to a great start as well. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Ari Wald will be joining us from Oppenheimer & Company. He's still pretty bullish on the market. He thinks we're going higher, as high as maybe 2,500. A lot of strength to this market. Intermarket analysis is pointing the way that stocks are heading higher. You're going to want to hear why. He sees no trouble on the horizon, despite these little hiccups that we occasionally get from week to week. He'll be joining me in hour one. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. And Dan Steffens will be joining us as we talk about energy. Inventory levels have been going up and down, and they're more volatile, something we're going to cover extensively next week. But the surprising thing, everybody's talking about shale oil production. Of all the shale plays in the country, there's only one that is actually increasing production, and you want to hear why, and why he thinks oil prices, despite where they are today, could be heading to $60 a barrel. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, if you are an investor, there are a number of ways which you can successfully make money in the markets, either following the fundamentals, technical analysis, or momentum investing. So these are generally called the Fab Five, the Dogs of the Dow, and the Dividend Aristocrats. And the real question is, which one are you going to follow? So what we're going to do on the big picture today is to have an analysis of each of the three strategies and show you how well they have done over the last two decades. And it should be an interesting time if you're trying to pick one for investing. And then we'll have an interview with Louis Gav from Gav Cal Research. That'll be between Jim and Louis Gav as the second part of the big picture today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, we'd like to look at all of the machinations and things going on, interacting with the markets down on Wall Street and elsewhere. It's been a very exciting week, Ryan Poplava. We had the French political elections going on last weekend. President Trump's proposed tax cuts, which are all the buzz right now. Nobody really knows quite what the plan is. It's emerging as we're watching it. It's a work in progress. There were earnings announcements, talk of a major conflict with North Korea, a lot of trepidation and buzz over that one. So if we sort of put that on a shelf and look underneath it all, what would you say are the drivers shaping the risk on or risk off mentality of investors this week? Basically, it's your interpretation of the week's events.
We call it the wrap up. I guess, John, risk on was clearly in play early in the week. If we looked at the market internals, what was moving in the market to the upside, looking at high yield was doing well. Stocks were doing well, specifically growth oriented and very cyclically sensitive areas of the market were doing well, specifically financials. And that came out of the gate from essentially the results of the first round of the French election. There's another round, at least, what is it, two or three, coming up with Macron versus Le Pen, moving on to the next round. And that was sort of the middle case scenario where we didn't get both of the candidates that wanted to leave the EU. That would have been the worst case scenario for stocks, at least. And given that Macron has gotten a lot of heavy endorsement from other candidates that have dropped out, so far the polls have Macron as the likely candidate to win. And so that definitely lifted stocks on Monday. It's kind of like the same situation of, you know, November 8th with our elections, getting more certainty of what the market was looking at. And that brought about that risk on mentality, that animalistic spirits in the market, if you will. The results didn't have the same effect globally, though. Looking at European indices, they were up around 2 to 4%, depending on which countries and the indexes you were looking at, and only a percent gain for the S&P. But nonetheless, it was clear from market internals, like I said, that risk was on, with banks outperforming tech, specifically semiconductors within tech, capital goods, materials and transports, all very cyclically sensitive areas of the market performing well. The other item that hit late Monday that helped actually tack on a few more points to the S&P was an article from the Wall Street Journal announcing that Trump wants to tax cut the corporate rate down to 15%, even if it means lost revenue. So that initially added a little bit more. He'd been talking a lot about that in his campaign to try and win votes. And so it looks like he's wanting to carry forward with that promise. With the actual unveiling of that plan occurred on Wednesday by the Treasury Secretary. Markets rallied through Tuesday in similar form in anticipation of that happening. So stocks were also helped on Tuesday by a number of industrial and capital goods earnings announcements. This was, in fact, the busiest week in earnings announcements in 10 years. Just the moons aligned with company earnings, and there were quite a few that came out. Some mixed results on some days, but overall, very exciting results in technology. Some of the major super caps, Amazon, Google, showing some great results, and many of these capital and industrial companies were also guiding higher for forward results. So that really helped on Tuesday as well. A lot of good moves in the market this week. We didn't quite break the 2400 area on the S&P, but the NASDAQ broke 6,000. We're at all-time highs currently, and a very small pullback on Thursday and Friday.
But it did seem like, despite these catalysts, you know, the S&P 500 couldn't quite pull out a new high above 2400. So what held back the bullish charge?
Well, I'd say Trump's bill, even when it was being discussed in that Wall Street Journal article on Monday, it was written that the plan meant a loss of revenue. So even though everyone wants lower taxes, even Democrats, I'm sure, paying their own taxes would prefer not to be paying as much. Republicans, you know, that's their big corner, is lowering taxes. It's going to be hard sell for Congress in general to pass if it isn't fiscally sound, with a sort of a budget neutral bias. Remember, we talked about that 2 months ago with some of the Ways and Means members of that committee saying, hey, this bill, whatever Trump wants to do, he said phenomenal tax bill back on February 8th. A lot of these members are saying it's got to be neutral. We've got to continue to have a fiscally sound budget. Do we have one right now? Not really. We keep raising the cap on our debt. We're not really reining it in. And I think we're still having to deal with that next week with another vote round. You know, when the plan was announced on Wednesday, it was on one page with bullet points that left a lot of unanswered questions, left a lot of concerns for both parties. So if you read the actual plan presented, and it's actually really easy to find, you can Google it very quickly, Google Trump tax plan. And it was, in fact, the first image that I was able to bring up. And it reads like a Billboard top 10 song list. I mean, it's just a tax wish list, rather than, in my opinion, a plan that might be able to get through both the Senate and the House. So let's read some of these proposed cuts here, and I'll leave you the opinion for our listeners. Three tax brackets, 10%, 25%, and 35%, double standard deduction, help with childcare, more so than what is currently available, repeal the AMT, death tax, and 3.8% net investment income tax on individuals with incomes over $200,000, a 15% corporate tax rate. You know, that's the big one. From what I'm hearing from a lot of people, they're saying it would have been a win just having something in the high 20s. Border taxation is what they're trying to do to add revenues, and then a one-time tax on overseas dollars help bring those dollars back into the U.S., do a one-time tax on them, and probably low, not really stating what that rate would be. In the end, the plan calls for a process through the month of May in which the administration will work with Congress to develop the details to pass basically in both chambers. So currently there are three House Republicans criticizing the task to eliminate, and I didn't see this on the bill, but supposedly this is somewhere, saying that they want to eliminate deductibility of state and local taxes due to their state's high taxation. So Leonard Lance was one of the reps of New Jersey Republicans, said that the last time this tax change was attempted was back in 1986, and it was definitely scratched at that point. It was never passed. So one of the articles I read, John, on Bloomberg highlighted there are 28 House Republicans in high tax states of New Jersey, New York, and California that if we want to see this tax bill passed, if the Republicans want to see it passed, they could really ill afford losing 28 House Republicans in the House. So from the phenomenal tax plan, as Trump announced on February 8th, that may be its biggest problem. It's just too phenomenal to pass. And if it does, with a simple majority vote is what the Republicans are probably aiming for, that possibly makes this change temporary instead of long-term, temporary meaning maybe 3 years.
Well, the stock market didn't seem to let too much air out of its sails by the comments that we're seeing, because we're still really close to the highs. And so even though there's a lot of speculation, say, about the tax plan, the market's doing its own thing.
It is. And you're very much right. You know, if this was a lot more dire, I'm feeling like if we're looking at the PE ratio on the S&P, you drop off 1 point on 140 earnings per year, we could be looking at it, you know, 100 point drop. We can be closing on that 200-day average if we get to a point where investors really start to lose confidence in the Trump administration to continue to move in the areas that he wants to move on. There's been a lot of talk about his 100 days of office that's coming up this Saturday. And, you know, what has he accomplished? He's actually done more executive orders than anybody since Roosevelt. What he's been able to do is grab the low-lying fruit, the stuff he has direct influence over, he's been able to do. And now he's got to work with Congress. So to me, John, it's not so much an issue that, you know, the market didn't lose the wind, but I'm kind of left saying here on Friday that, you know, is this as good as it gets? Because there were so many widely held stocks that blew away earnings this week in tech and the industrials earlier on Tuesday. It just feels like the initial move in these stocks on Friday should have helped the S&P break 2400, just considering how much of a big chunk of the S&P's performance is tied to these five super cap stocks. But there was something else at play. You know, Trump mentioned to Reuters, you mentioned at the beginning of the section about North Korea. Trump mentioned to Reuters in the Oval Office interview on Thursday that there's a chance of a major conflict with North Korea, but he said he would rather resolve issues diplomatically, including several economic sanctions he says are currently on the table before there's any kind of boots on the ground. Some of the best performers Friday were gold mining stocks, which was odd because gold was only up around 0.25%. But, you know, the best performing area being gold, also looking at treasury yields. I was looking at the 10-year treasury, which seems to be holding under 2.3% for the time being. You look at those areas. If we want to get above 2400 for the S&P, I think you got to see either a correction in gold and also probably a correction in treasuries, a rise in treasury yields. And we're not seeing that right now. So when I'm looking at on Monday with this risk on mentality, and in fact, I wrote internally to a lot of our advisors here that I felt like the intermediate term correction was over because we broke a couple of trend lines. The high yield was breaking out and doing well. While I said that, I'm looking at treasuries and still seeing seeing that it seems to be that there's a little bit of a premium in there based on what's going on with North Korea. Also based on, I mean, if we look at the monetary policy in early March, when we saw that the dot plot was looking at only 3 rate hikes this year, one already out of the way, that's what we saw in December. So same plan, the market was imagining possibly 4 rate hikes this year. So this whole idea of, you know, rates are going to go up gradually and at a very slow pace, possibly even less. I mean, we look at the GDP figure that came out here on Friday, 0.7%. And looking at recent soft data, you got to look at treasuries. You got to look at gold. So you've got some premium in there regarding geopolitical events, but also possibly some concerns over slow growth. So as I said, you know, Friday, I'm looking at things. Is this as good as it gets? We got to look at economics next week. I think that's going to be a key factor for the markets.
And it was a busy week in market news, to say the least. So plenty of moving parts, lots of things to watch, it would seem.
Definitely.
Next week, are we continuing this or something special popping up?
Well, like I said, I think we go back to looking at economics. We had a number of regional numbers in manufacturing through the month of April that started to hint towards this idea of slower growth. We knew that by looking at the Atlanta's now forecast for GDP that we were looking at a below 1%, even though consensus was a little bit higher. So we're seeing that economics, while we've seen some softness right now, we need to see possible rebound. And so looking at the jobs numbers and figures next Friday will be a big data point. I'm also looking at auto sales next week. And then, the ISM figures for manufacturing and services for the month of April. We're expecting those to be weak, but we're going to be looking at the internals of that information, looking at new orders and things like that that are leading. And then there's the FOMC meeting on May 3rd. Are there still communicating that we're going to have these gradual rate increases? Are we looking at one possibly in June? We're going to hopefully hear from them on what they're concerned about and maybe what we shouldn't be concerned about. So tune into the FOMC meeting next week. But we're beginning to watch credit areas more closely. As I said, we're watching the treasuries, watching high yield, how they react. And like I said, looking at autos with the figures that we saw last month with a drop in March, we're looking to see what happened in April. Hopefully we see rebound, but like I said, economics next week and the FOMC, that'll be the place to watch.
Yep, should be interesting next week. As you said, they're interesting times, so things keep clicking forward, and I appreciate it. All right, Ryan Poplava, see you again next week.
We'll see you next week, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
If you look at the market, you can have periods of double-digit returns annualized for more than 2 decades. There's periods also where investing, you will have earned, after inflation, next to nothing. A good example of that is imagine if you retired in the year 1930, right when the Great Depression was beginning. For the next 20 years, you earned annualized 0.5%. You would not want to have retired just before the Great Depression. But let's look at it a little bit differently. If you were fortunate enough to retire in the year 1980, we had one of the greatest bull markets in history, was the 80s and 90s with the tech bubble. You earned 13.6% from the early 80s to 2000. So it really, really matters where you are in terms of the valuations of various asset classes when you retire.
Well, the market continues its upward thrust. It's an aging market. 8 years into this bull market, some are questioning, can it continue? Joining us on the program is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari, let's take a look at the S&P 500. We hit 2,400. We bounced right back up there again. On the day you and I are speaking, the market is down slightly. But what's your takeaway given the S&P, its advancement since 2009, and given the fact that we're 8 years into this bull market?
I think the important point is that what the market is exhibiting is mid-cycle conditions. And investors should be thinking about this market as healthy bull market conditions rather than anticipating for the next market top and the next downturn. That while it's really the age of the economic cycle that I think has many concerned, while we're 8 years into the economic cycle, price action has reset through that eight-year upturn since the 2009 low, most recently in that 2015 to 2016 period. That had all the characteristics of a non-recessionary bear market that we found, looking back at history, going back to 1928, the best one-rule definition of a major cycle low is not the 20% decline that many people use, but instead the act of falling to an 18-month low. And that if you look through history, if you look at every 18-month low through history, it generally picks up what you and I consider those important market bottoms. Sure enough, February 2016, we were only down 15% from the prior high in 9 months prior. But the market had retraced 18 months of prior performance. And if you look at the activity since then, internal breadth has brought in, the leadership has turned pro-cyclical, credit has improved, rates have backed up. It's all the characteristics and behavior you'd expect to see at the early stages of a new bull market. I think that was a very early cycle behavior. I think we're transitioning more mid-cycle now, but the important point being, we think this bull market is intact. We think it's healthy. We think these minor pullbacks like that exhibited in March should be bought. And we think the S&P 500 makes new highs. In fact, our target for the year is 2,500. That's actually less so a target. And just looking back at history and looking at what the average performance is in year two following a major market low, like we saw in 2016, average performance tends to be about 10 to 12%. That's how we derived to that 2,500 level, looking at where we were coming into the year.
Now, typically in any kind of market, you see some sectors that are standing out within the S&P, and surely we've seen that with the technology sector reflected also, Ari, in the NASDAQ hitting 6,000 for the first time. Do you see typically when you get into this, let's say, mid-cycle market cycle, you see rotations from, let's say, a handoff from one sector to the other that continues the market upward?
That's correct. That in general, market rotations characterize a healthy advance, because what happens is that no sector becomes too strong and no sector becomes too weak to really become an issue and drag everything lower. And instead, what happens, you have these rotations that help register these incremental market gains. Now, over the past few years, these rotations have really been driven by a lot of the inner market factors, interest rates, commodity prices, currencies, where investors have, you know, really flooded back and forth into financials, out of it and back into utilities, or vice versa, in and out of energy, in and out of consumer discretionary. And through these market rotations, technology has really been the one standout that's been able to withstand those oscillations in the inner market activity. That it's been a very steady outperformer over the past few years. Just given the broad-based nature of the strength in the sector, we really think it's a prime candidate to continue to lead these gains. That if this is a secular bull market, we think tech can really be that leadership, not only in 2017, but beyond as well, when you consider that the strength has been throughout capitalizations. It's not just your large cap tech stocks. Mid cap tech has been very strong. Small cap tech has been exceptional. And it's been across industries as well. The semiconductor space has had a terrific year. We think some of that rotation can now maybe move back to some of the internet and software names, tech hardware also coming around as well. So that's really as far as a long-term idea. As much as tech can be considered near-term overbought, we think its strength can continue. As far as more tactical rotation ideas, the two standouts for us are the industrial sector and consumer discretionary. Now, industrials had a terrific post-election run, and since then they've underperformed. But they've held support levels And we see it. It's still a very broad-based move. And we think industrials, you know, getting into this idea of rotation can now take on that leadership role once again. Consumer discretionary as well. Although still pressured to a certain degree by the more traditional retailers, we are seeing strength broaden out ex the retailers into a lot of the restaurant names. A lot of the internet retailers have remained strong. A lot of the auto component names as well. And discretionary, following 15 months of underperformance, has also shown signs of turning the corner and looks likely to benefit from market rotations looking out the coming months.
So, Ari, one, I guess, cautious question to ask. If there was the idea that we might be approaching a market top, typically there's a culprit that drags the market lower. You have one sector that might have been a former leadership sector. It begins to roll over. It gets overextended and begins to roll over. Do you see anything like that as you view the S&P right now?
We always like to put on our bear cap. And that's an important point, is that we have trouble finding and identifying that culprit. You know, traditionally, small caps tend to be a late cycle warning when they start to break down. They have underperformed year to date, but how we see it, small caps haven't broke down and actually more recently showing some signs of inflecting higher, so you don't have it in small caps. At the sector level, energy potentially, you know, has been a major market headwind, speaking in terms of the big downturn in 2014, 2015. Now more recently under pressure again as crude oil has dipped. But while potentially an underperformer, I think energy also has turned the corner. And I think after that massive destruction can start building a base too. Looking out internationally, Europe would be a potential culprit. But this has really been probably one of the big global laggards in recent years. Now, this is both kind of how we see it, the bull and bear case. If there is a major top in the next 12 months, you know, that culprit could be Europe. And, you know, looking at the Europe stocks 50 or the 600, still in secular decline, technically speaking, that unlike the S&P 500, which is above its 2000 and 2007 highs, Europe hasn't accomplished this just yet. It's still below that significant resistance. So if we see Europe rally back, start to stall at that secular resistance and top out, that could be the culprit and drag on everything else. We don't see that. We actually see a case where Europe can break higher. It's a call that we've heard a lot from the fundamental community, the opportunity in Europe. And every time we hear that, we get really excited. Because if they're right about Europe, that there's this tremendous opportunity and Europe breaks higher and moves into this new secular bull market, the S&P 500, how we see it, is going significantly higher. S&P 500 is going to go for the ride under that scenario. And we think if they're right about Europe, at the same time, I think they're way too low on their forecast for the S&P 500, that I think under such a scenario, the S&P 500 can go significantly higher.
Let's talk about something that usually happens. It's seasonality. Typically, the old adage on Wall Street, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. Ari, that hasn't necessarily worked out over the last couple of years. I mean, last year at this time, we were worried about Brexit. When Brexit actually took place, liquidity came into the market and we had a nice summer rally.
That's correct. And, you know, for us, seasonals are secondary confirmation. And more important is the trend. And if you were to take those seasonal studies and look at how the market performed in each of those months, whether it was above or below its 200-day moving average, which acts as a great proxy for what the trend's doing, when you're above the 200-day moving average, when you're in an uptrend, performance specifically in May, June, and July tends to be much better than when it's the other way around, that there's typically a weak trend going into that month, where you then have a pickup in weakness, that there's weakness going into that seasonal period of weakness. Uptrend or not, later in Q3, August and September in particular, do tend to be months where the S&P is vulnerable to downside shocks. So as we approach those more later summer months, we're going to be looking at indicators like credit spreads and internal breadth to see if there's any signs of stress underneath the surface. If credit spreads are widening or if breadth becomes a little bit more narrow here, that could tip us off that we could be due for another Q3 shock to the downside. But as it stands now, we don't see those signs, and we think the higher trend is more important here. And we recommend against selling in May.
So as you look at this, it's safe to say in terms of leadership right now, you're seeing technology, industrials, and consumer discretionary is the strongest sectors providing leadership in the S&P. Let's look at some other markets, particularly intermarket analysis. Let's look at the treasury market and oil prices as well as the dollar. Let's begin with treasuries because it seems like we've been in a narrow trading range when the market took off after the election. We got up to a little over 2.6, but we've been trading kind of almost like in the 30-35 basis point trading range between, let's say, 2.25 and 2.65.
Right. Speaking in terms of the 10-year treasury yield, our take is that while rates have turned lower, you know, really since March, what was interesting is that we did have this disinflationary reaction to the Fed rate hike. To us, we think it was more of a function of the what was a really near parabolic move higher following the November U.S. election, that yields, as much as they moved lower, they're still above a rising 200-day moving average, so you can make the case that the trend is still higher. So we think, accordingly, there could be a ricochet move higher over the coming months. We're thinking of it more as a range-bound rate market with support at about 2.1%. And the key resistance level that the 10-year has had trouble pushing through is 2.65%. If you could get through 2.65, you can make the case to 3%. But how we see it, too early to call for an end of this 30-year downtrend in interest rates. Kind of how we see it, there could be some secular base building here. But our take is that interest rates should be range-bound for a number of quarters looking ahead.
Let's move on to oil. We've been hanging out in the $50 range, kind of 53, 54. We're back down below 50. What do you see happening with oil, especially with the talk that OPEC may possibly extend those cuts in production for the remainder of the year?
Oil hasn't been trading well from a technical perspective. I think the best spin I could put on it is that oil is simply dead money that trades in a range looking ahead, that the inability to sustain the breakout at $51 in March was concerning to us, and it did put oil back in its prior range, somewhere between $45 and $55. This makes sense to us. If you look back historically, oil has tended to trade in ranges for months, quarters, even years at a time. If you look back to the 1950s and 1960s, and then again in the 1980s and 1990s as well. So how we see it, this is very typical behavior from the oil market, and we think it's behavior that can continue. There could be some speculative trading bounces and ways for a trader to make money both on the upside and downside. But in general, from that long-term investment standpoint, it's an area we would be staying away from.
All right, let's move on next to two asset classes that tend to move in opposite directions, and that's gold and the dollar. What's your take on gold here?
For gold as well, we think that the downturn from 2011 to 2015 has ended. But building a base is very different than a new uptrend. And for us, gold is still building a base. That, again, similar to our view for commodities as a whole, we think a lot of these commodity prices aren't going to be range-bound for through the remainder of the year. And that includes gold. Now, the key level on the upside, at what point are we wrong? At what point does gold enter a new bull market? And 1380 is on our monitor. If you can push above 1380, the price of gold, at that point you do have a higher low followed by a higher high as well. But that would really be the first meaningful higher high for the price of gold in a number of years. That would be a major breakout move. That would mark how we see at the start of a new uptrend. As it stands now, we think there's still going to be additional base building is needed. You can see gold's 200-day moving average is still sloped sideways, which is indicative of a sideways range. And accordingly, we think gold is more or less dead money through the remainder of the year. Now, the dollar has retreated over the past few months. Gold has bounced. And now I think we could be at a point where you see that go the other way, where the dollar starts to strengthen and pressure the price of gold. If you look underneath the surface in the pairs, it's a little bit more mixed. dollar has been stronger, say, against the Canadian dollar, against the Japanese yen, a little bit weaker against the euro and the British pound. So I think there's some more bifurcation underneath the surface, and it depends on which dollar pair we're talking about.
So despite the fact that the Fed is raising interest rates now, you don't expect a summer swoon like we have had in the past. So if you were to put money to work right now, Ari, would you put it in those three sectors that are leading right now, technology, industrials, and consumer discretionary?
I would. Those would be our three favorite sectors, areas we recommend overweighting, and areas that we recommend putting new money to work. And in general, I would say don't be worried because the Fed is tightening interest rates. That if you look back historically, bull markets can continue through a tightening cycle, that forward performance can remain strong through tightening cycles, that it really is not until the Fed tightens to the point where the yield curve inverts that you're at greater risk of an economic recession, that an inversion in the yield curve, not a flattening one, has been your more worrisome signal that an equity market top might be at hand, and we're not there yet.
Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Oppenheimer, how could they do so?
They can follow me on Twitter at Ari Wald.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
There's too much to fit in a weekend financial program. That's why we do a daily version of the Financial Sense News Hour, just like this weekday show.
The big story in Fed policy is the Fed is talking about reducing the size of its balance sheet. Let me put that in English. The Fed has $4.5 trillion on their balance sheet. Roughly three of it is Treasury securities that they own. Reducing the balance sheet means they're going to get rid of those securities on their balance sheet. The marketplace has to absorb them, and I'm using those words specifically. That will probably lead to higher rates as well, but that's not happening, you know, at the earliest until later this year and probably into 2018. And my fear is that the Fed is underestimating the power of their balance sheet, and that as we get into 2018, one of the big stories could be is that that could lead to some instability in the marketplace. That could lead to spiking rates higher as the market starts to realize it's going to be buried with supply. The biggest buyer of treasuries right now, bar none, is the Federal Reserve through their balance sheet. If you lose the biggest buyer in a market, you have to adjust prices, and they could adjust much higher, much faster.
Well, the big question coming up as we head into the summer months, will OPEC extend their production cuts? And if they don't, what could happen to the price of oil? Recently, oil has weakened after hitting a midterm high of about $54. We're below 50. Where's oil heading in the future? Joining us from Energy Perspectives Group is Dan Steffen. Dan, let's talk about oil inventories, because the market seems to be really focused. Every time we get an inventory number, if it's up, the price of crude comes down. If we've had a big withdrawal, it goes in the opposite direction. Why don't you give us a little perspective? Because we get into a lot of seasonalities when it comes to energy consumption, and we're about ready to head into some of the demand peak for gasoline usage as the summer driving season begins.
Yeah, that's something that people really don't focus on much, is the seasonality of oil demand, because it used to be that a lot of higher percentage of the people used heating oil to heat their homes. I mean, nowadays, I mean, almost 95% of all new homes are heating with natural gas. The only ones that don't are in areas where they can't hook up to the grid. But you're not seeing a lot of new homes with, you know, heating oil furnaces in the basement anymore. So you get a the difference between the first quarter and the third quarter, there's about 1.5 million barrels a day of demand for refined products. And obviously in the third quarter, it's summer demand for gasoline and diesel for transportation fuels. And also, summer blend gasolines in the United States require more crude oil than in the winter months. Winter blends, they can blend in more butane and, about 10% of NGLs into the refining mix, and they need to use more crude oil in the summer months. So that's why over the last 4 weeks, we've seen a big increase in the amount of crude that's being taken into refineries. And that's one reason why the last 3 weeks, we have seen declines in U.S. crude oil inventory.
Let's talk about that for a minute, too, because another factor that plays in, there's seasonality where you see a lot of these refiners go through downtime where they basically do maintenance on refineries because they have to do that because a refinery is a very dangerous place to work. You're working with chemicals and a very flammable type commodity. Let's talk about what happens in between seasons. In other words, when they switch from the different blends of fuel, and then also you have, for example, the shoulder months of the year when the weather's really nice and people aren't consuming as much energy.
Yeah, February, March, April is kind of the lowest point of demand on refiners. So what they do each year, they have to do something called, they call it a turnaround, and they have to go test all their valves, and they have to, go through a bunch of testing, and it's all required by law that they do this, and they just need to do it anyway. And then there's maintenance, and if there's any leaking valves or anything, they have to replace all those. So you get a decline in refinery utilization. So it's like you and I, we don't burn crude oil in our cars. So refiners are the ones that use crude oil. So we got below 90%. I think it went all the way down to like 85% utilization of the refiners. And now we're back up to 94% in the last EIA report. So you got refineries are ramping up now to produce more gasoline and diesel for the summer demand. So crude oil inventories have been going down, but gasoline and diesel inventories have been going up. And that's a little bit that's concerned these traders. But, I mean, it's just normal seasonality. That's just what happens.
Now, you have a presentation where you talk about refinery crude demand will surge by 3.5 million barrels a day between March and July, with most of the increase coming from the Atlantic Basin refiners in the Middle East. You know, there's this feeling because of shale oil production. How much do we import a day into this country?
We're importing about 9 to 10 million barrels a day.
So there's no way I see the U.S. becoming energy independent where we would no longer have to import oil into this country.
Yeah, it would take a massive effort for us to become energy independent. We still import about half of the crude oil that we need. I mean, our refiners run about 17 million barrels a day of crude oil that they need. And we are now producing about 9 million barrels a day. But one problem is the shale production is very light oil. And most of our refiners were geared up for heavier crudes. So we're actually now exporting about 1 million barrels a day of this light crude. It's going over to European or Asian refineries that are set up to handle it. And we've been importing more heavy crudes. I mean, sometimes to most people, it doesn't make any sense. They think crude oil is crude oil, but it's not. And it just depends on what your refinery is set up to do.
Yeah, it seems like oil has been trading within a, I would say, almost $7, $8 trading range with support at 48 and maybe resistance at 55. But I want to talk about something about shale production. Rig counts we see keep going up each week, and they're up significantly. But Dan, I wonder if you might explain for our listeners, if you take a look at all the major shale formations in this country, the Permian, the Eagle Ford, the Bakken, there's only one that is really up significantly, which is the Permian.
Yeah, of the seven major ones, the Permian's up. Also in Oklahoma, there's a play called Stack. Scoop and Stack are these two. There's only a few public companies that are in that play, but they're also increasing production up there. But the Eagle Ford production's way down. Bakken's still on decline. Niobrara's up slightly, but the Permian is where all of this production growth is coming. Like today, half of the onshore rigs in the United States are working in Texas, and most of them are working in the Permian Basin.
Why is that, that you're seeing most of the increase come from the Permian? Is it because it's more economical to, let's say, drill for shale in the Permian than these other areas?
Well, yeah, it is. And one reason, of course, is you have infrastructure out there. And plus, if you've ever been out there, there's hardly anybody living in that area. I mean, it's pretty much desert. So you've got wide open, access to the lands and roads and things. And it's just easier You got a lot of takeaway capacity with pipelines, but that's even becoming constrained. They're building new pipelines to take the oil out of there. I mean, it's just a very developed area with a lot of oil field service companies out there and things. And actually, their lifting cost, once they drill these wells, now the wells are expensive, the leasehold's expensive, you know, they take, you know, all-in cost is $7 or $8 million per horizontal well. But once that well's done, the actual lifting costs are only like $5 a barrel. So if you're selling oil for, let's say, $45, and you only got $5, you're cash flow positive at $40 a barrel. And these wells are producing, you know, 1,000 barrels a day. So $40,000 a day pays off the wells pretty quick. I mean, they're still, at today's price, they're paying off in a year and a half, some of these really good wells out there.
I want to talk about something that is sort of a, they say shale is acting as a cap on oil and OPEC is acting as a floor. They met last year. They agreed to cut their production. It went into effect in January. And there's talk on, I guess they meet, May 25th, whether they'll extend those production cuts into the second half of the year. But there's two events. One is Saudi Aramco's IPO, which is supposed to be the biggest IPO in history. I don't think that would go over well if we were talking about $30 or $40 oil again. But secondly, Dan, OPEC knows with shale production ramping up in the U.S., if they don't cut production, the price of oil is going down, which means to get the same amount of cash, they're going to have to pump 20, 30% more oil. Why wouldn't they extend that?
I know. It makes like no sense. And the downside for the cartel members, to me, is so gigantic, not to mention it would put egg on their face almost because they came up with this plan. But I do think we're going to see a much tightening of the supply and demand in just a couple months. I mean, the second quarter, you start getting demand really picking up and things will start showing up. But if they just keep their production agreement in place for another 6 months, I think the market will be much tighter by the end of the year.
You know what really strikes me about this period of time? I'm watching a documentary on Netflix called The Prize. It was the book written by Daniel Yergin, The Story of Oil. And what really struck me is when oil was discovered in Titusville and you had all these thousands of guys that were putting in drilling rigs and drilling for oil, the price of oil would just gyrate all over the place until Rockefeller came in with Standard Oil and brought a semblance of order. Well, eventually, Roosevelt administration broke up Standard Oil, and then we got into a crazy price for oil again. Until the 30s, when the government came in, just like Standard Oil, they regulated oil with the Texas Railroad Commission, which worked. And then you had OPEC come in and take the role as regulator. Now it seems like we're back into that crazy period of time. We're seeing a lot more volatility because there isn't one strong, overwhelming force, whether it's the government, OPEC, or Standard Oil, to regulate the oil business.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of unique about oil, even though it's in massive demand, I mean, within a couple of years, we're going to be using 100 million barrels a day of refined products, most of which are going to be refined from crude oil. And it's so important to our standard of living. Yet, a small surplus of supply or a small, you know, lack of supply, a small surplus of demand oversupply can have an incredibly magnified effect on the price of it. And right now, it's now like we're 10% oversupplied. What led to this was only like a 1.5% to 2% oversupply. And on a commodity that basically you can store for a long time, it's not like it spoils. So the impact that it has on price is pretty phenomenal. And usually high prices lead to lack of investment and you get this and that. And that's why it rebalances. And that's why they call them cycles for a reason, because then you get a period of not enough investment. And you're looking at a shortage. And I've seen articles recently where we're pretty much by the end of 2018, there's been so many large international projects either canceled or pushed way back that we could be looking at a shortage if we don't get after it again. Even in the Permian, this conference I went to on Tuesday, they talk about all this oil is going to come out of the Permian. To get it, we're going to have to drill over 600,000 wells. Well, multiply 600,000 by $7 million per well. It's an unbelievable amount of money a capital that has to be invested to get the supply that we're going to need in the future years. So,
and as we take a look at this, what about also, in addition to OPEC and state actors, you have the major Western oil companies from Exxon to Total to Eni to Chevron. They have laid off a considerable amount of personnel. They've cut back on major long-term projects. Sooner or later, as you point out, we're going to be consuming 100 million barrels a day. At the same time, we have something called oil depletion, which continues unabated, doesn't matter what the price is. Aren't we setting ourselves up for a shock somewhere down the road unless new investments are made?
Well, the one thing, the more and more dependent you become on shale, and I say shale, but also tight formations, a lot of these wells in the Permian are not really shale wells. They're just drilled into tight sand or tight limestone formations. But regardless, those wells do have very steep decline curves. So you get to the point where once you get thousands and thousands, even tens of thousands of these wells on decline, you're caught in this treadmill where you have to continually keep adding new wells to offset the decline of the old ones. And God, I can't remember, but our, like, the global decline rate on all wells put together is only like 3 or 4%. But the United States is now up to like 18 or 20% because we've become so dependent on these shale wells. So, you know, as long as we've got tier one acres and we can keep drilling out, the production keeps going up. A perfect example is, remember the Barnett Shale when it was all the rage and that's where all this increasing natural gas was coming from? Well, they have drilled out all of the tier one acreage in the Barnett. And so there's no way, you can't drill enough new wells in the tier two and tier three acreage to offset the decline of the best wells. That's what happens to every oil and gas field. So the Barnett Shale is on terminal decline. There's nothing that can be done to reverse it. And that's eventually what's going to happen in these shale plays as well. You'll drill up all the best acreage in the Eagle Ford or the best acreage in the Permian. Now, the Permian's got a lot of tier one acreage, so it's maybe a decade before that happens, but at some point in time, you drill it all up. That's it.
So given the nature of this kind of market, where would you be if you were investing in energy right now? Would you be investing with the large cap companies? Would you be with the drillers, the midstream companies, downstream integrated? I mean, what looks good in this kind of market right now?
Well, I tell you what looks really good to me, and you don't hear anybody talking about it. I think in the second half of this year, the U.S. natural gas and NGL market's going to be a heck of a lot better. It's really going to tighten up. Our gas production is down year over year, and demand's really going to spike this summer. You got Cheniere is bringing on another, we call it a train down there. They're going to increase demand for gas by like 2 billion cubic feet a day out of their Sabine Pass facility for export. And then, you know, in the summer, demand for power generation for air conditioning increases, and you've got to refill storage, got lower than it did last year, so we got to refill that. But also, we have a lot of industrial demand for gas and NGLs. Now, NGLs are natural gas liquids. That's your butane, propane, everything. And Range Resources just reported their first quarter earnings. I'd urge everybody to look at it because you can. They're, like, in my opinion, the number one natural gas producer in North America, and they've got a lot of good information about in their presentation about how tight the gas and NGL market's going to be. And another thing, on some of these oil field supplies, the really top-tier drilling companies, these are the guys that provide the rigs, like people like Helmerich & Payne, Patterson, UTI, Precision Drilling. Their top-end rigs are in high demand, and the drilling companies are not going to build new equipment until they're absolutely sure they can use it. You know, so you'll get to where the oil field services will get a little constrained. And then you also, you know, you got to get crews, so you got to go hire people. And that takes a little bit of time. And also the frac sand companies to me look really strong.
So, Dan, if we were looking at the end of the year, let's assume that OPEC is going to extend their production cuts into the second half of the year. And finally, we start seeing this drawdown. I know that some of these Caribbean island storage places are starting to be drawn down. It's starting to come off ships. When would you see this market in balance in higher prices, or would you expect lower prices?
I think just the announcement that they're going to officially extend the agreement to the end of the year is going to cause a spike in oil prices, because I think everybody can kind of see that the fundamentals are tightening things up, and you should see a big drop in crude oil storage in the U.S. and Europe during the third quarter if they extend the agreement. So I think $60 oil is possible by the end of the year.
$60? Okay, that's something the market's not anticipating right now. Dan, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at Energy Prospectus Group, tell them how they could do so.
Well, you could just log on to energyprospectus.com. And if you'd like to join, it's $350 a year. We publish reports on over 100 individual companies per year, have a newsletter. I have a weekly podcast. It's like 10 or 15 minutes, kind of an update on where the oil and gas markets are today. And I send that out every week. And we also have a forum. You can get in our chat room and talk about, you know, ask me questions direct. Or we have a lot of members that are in the industry that chime in on the questions. So it's really good stuff. And if you want to just go to energyprospectus.com, check it out.
All right, Dan. And congratulations on becoming another grandparent.
Yeah, we have an Easter bunny baby born Easter morning. So pretty fun.
Well, enjoy the new family member. Listen, thanks for coming on the program.
All right, thank you.
Strategies for investing. Instead of strategies, you say strategies. You want to have the right strategy so you don't have a tragedy in your investing. What are the strategies for investment? There are three primary ones: Fab Five, Dogs of the Dow, and Dividend Aristocrats. Coming up next on The Big Picture, we're going to tell you what each of them is, how well they have done, and which ones might just work for you, depending on your investment philosophy. And then Jim has an extensive interview with Louis Gav from Gav Kalb Research. Coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.